everyone. Welcome to the Parkscope Unprofessional Podcast Hour. It's been a while. We haven't done this in a while. I'm really excited tonight. Joining us tonight is maybe Mike. He was doing fine until right before we were going to record, and then everything kind of went kaput on us. So I'm not sure what's going on. We're trying to call him. We're working on it right now. Technical difficulties. Also joining us tonight is Bob Selinger. He is from the Unofficial Guide series. Bob, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. You?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. It's a little cold in Ohio, but, you know, it's the winter. And Mike.
Oh, hey.
There we go. We just started recording, so you didn't miss anything. And Mike, how are you doing?
I'm good.
Cool. So let's start off real quick. We're going to do a... This is the Unprofessional Podcast Hour, in case anyone forgets. We're going to cover some of the news. So let's start off with Disney real quick. Mike, you were in the parks recently. Do you want to cover some of your thoughts on New Fantasyland? I think this is the first time you've seen it, right?
It's the second time, but the first time, I guess I did it the right way.
Okay, explain.
Well, I was very fortunate, and I'm very fortunate to know people and have good friends that I've made over the years. And I got a comp pass to go in to Magic Kingdom, and I had also a friend that could help me out with fast passes to schedule them. So I was able to have 3 fast passes. Basically, that I could use as like an express pass anytime, anywhere, but 3 times. And so I got it at Magic Kingdom probably around 9:30. But before that, I went and had breakfast at Polynesian. I had Tonga Toast at Captain Cook's. And that was probably the most stressful part of my day because everybody and their brother has dining plan now. And they all have to have their entree and their snacks and all that stuff. So that takes a while to get through there now. But I had a nice little breakfast, and I took the monorail over to Magic Kingdom, and I did it clockwise. And I started off in Adventureland, and Jungle Cruise and Pirates were slammed. Pirates had a 10-minute wait on the sign, but when I walked in, the line was out the door, and I was like, nope. I said, I've seen Pirates enough. I'll see it again sometime in the future. I passed by the Skipper Cantina, but you really couldn't see much. It didn't look like it was even close to me, but they have the sign up now, according to internet. So I guess it's coming along. Splash Mountain, I thought about it for a hot second, and I was like, I don't feel like getting wet before I drive home, so I didn't. And I used my first fast pass in Big Thunder. Walked on.
Did we lose Mike? Mike?
But other than that, it's still fun.
Okay, we lost you a little bit, Mike.
Oh.
You just said you walked on to Big Thunder. Well, we missed that part.
That's where I used my first fast pass.
Okay.
And it's still a fun ride. They have turned off the boulders, I guess.
Yeah, in the finale collapse scene?
Yeah, so that's kind of lame. But, you know, I walked right onto that. And that's where I finally realized what Disney doesn't have that Universal has that makes Universal so easy for people like you and me is that they don't have single rider lines except for maybe at Everest. And I miss single rider line when I'm not at Universal because that's how we do everything so quickly and easily. So yeah, that's where it first came apparent because I had to wait to sit by myself. After that, I went to Mansion, and that's just a mess outside now. You walk up and you see Tangled, and you have to go through that stupid interactive queue. But other than that, ride looked fine. Still had fun. And then from there, I went to Fantasyland. I scowled at the Tangled toilets, and then I went to Mine Train, where I used my second Fast Pass, walked in, and that's a really fun little ride. It's my first time on it, and I'm glad I didn't have to wait. Walk right on, and I like the rocking doesn't add much as far as anything new as far as a sensation when you ride, but I feel it does make it more fluid. When you hit those curves, it's not herky-jerky like some coasters are. You just kind of ease into it, which is nice. I mean, it's nothing spectacular, but it doesn't have to be. It's a nice little addition. And I think with that open now, it really helps out Mermaid, whereas Mermaid doesn't have the long line now. And people aren't using their fast passes for it necessarily. So as soon as I got off of Mern Train, I went to Mermaid and walked right on. And the changes they made to that ride have made it so much better. I rode that, I guess, a couple years ago, and I didn't quite care for it, but it was at the end of the night, and I guess it had been built up so much that I just was underwhelmed. But now the full package of land being open and being able to just walk on like a proper Omni mover, I think it was a nice little ride. And I had forgotten how long it was, and I think it's a nice little ride. I think the problem with New Fantasyland that we all got caught up in was all the hype, and that it was this grand thing finally opening after X amount of years. And if they had just opened these things sporadically or not made such a big deal about it, or if things had been opening around the resort, I think it would have been nice. And I think it is nice now in hindsight. And I enjoyed myself in there. With a fast pass, I have to add that in.
Cool.
Yeah, after that I went to Tomorrowland and used a fast pass for Space, and I still waited about 15 minutes. And Space Mountain is Space Mountain. Had fun, and then I left.
Cool.
So that's my little... And then I met you at Beach Club.
Yeah, just to say bye before you left.
Yeah, I really wish I could have went to Epcot with you, though. That would have been fun.
Yeah, that would have been cool. So one of the Disney news that came up this past week was they finally announced the not-secret second Avatar ride, the Navi River Journey. Guests begin as they board canoes and venture down a mysterious sacred river hidden within the bioluminescent rainforest. There's like a shaman who sings or something also. It sounds a little bizarre, I'll be honest. Bob, do you have any thoughts on this, or have you heard anything?
Sounds bizarre to me too.
Glowing plants and singing aliens.
Wouldn't it be a Shaw woman?
I'm not sure.
Or is shaman a unisex term?
I think there's three shaman, and they're all from Detroit. It's a Motown thing.
Oh, that explains a lot. Okay. That's Joe Rohde going for the realism, like the parking lot in Dinoland USA, right?
Amen.
So that's the last attraction, the other one being Avatar Flight of Passage. And everything they still swear is opening in 2017, so I'll see.
Anybody still gives a shit?
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, we do curse a little bit, but not that much. Yeah. Anyway. Yep, 2017, guys. So, also they announced the Club Villain nighttime event at Hollywood Studios, which is $99 a person, plus park admission. And what I don't get is that I don't necessarily have anything against the idea of this, but for $100 you're basically at a buffet sitting with a bunch of people, like picnic bench seating. So that doesn't make sense. Why are you paying $100? I don't know, maybe it'll be cooler, but it's like a dance party and then there's a few villains and then you get your quote-unquote themed food, so the OU guys will make up food names for that.
I'm sure there's a cupcake involved,
probably. Yeah, do you have any thoughts on this, Bob?
You guys old enough to remember P.T. Barnum?
Yeah.
That's all you need to know.
Yeah, there's a sucker born every minute. Right?
Amen.
Yeah. So that was that. Also, they announced that the launch bay is opening in December, and that they're adding the Star Wars launch bay is opening December, and they're adding a special scene to Star Tours, I think next week, actually, on the 16th.
They never cease to amaze at how many ways they can find a sucker people to come to DHS over and over and over again. So they stagger these openings so these people have to keep coming.
Yeah, exactly. One every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
or closing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Bob, did you hear that in California they actually have I believe it's the Darth... What was it? It was like a Darth Chimichanga or a Darth Tamale? I think it's Darth Tamale is one of the food options they have in Tomorrowland now.
Happily, I missed that.
Yeah. That's as bad as the Sith and chips. So, so that's a bunch of fun. But anyway, let's done with Disney, because something really interesting happened this past week, and that was SeaWorld did a press conference, and some of the stuff got out a little early, but this is kind of the first big unveil That they did. SeaWorld's CEO, Joel Manby, he used to work, I believe, at Silver Dollar City and Dollywood. He took over SeaWorld Parks and Entertainment, and this is kind of the first big thing that he's announced. Some of the big things that are happening includes a SeaWorld Rescue roller coaster. they're not going to do any more whale shows in San Diego. Do you guys think that would possibly affect the parks? No more whale shows? Like, would that be big or small? What are you guys' thoughts?
I've never been to SeaWorld, so I really don't know.
I think it's big. Whale shows were SeaWorld's primary differentiator.
Yeah. I mean, they're not going to get rid of the whales. They're just not going to be doing the shows anymore. So I find that interesting. And I remember back when there was still a SeaWorld Ohio up in Aurora. The good old days. Also announced, which is really, really interesting, and I want to get some of your opinions on this, Bob, is that they also announced that Universal Orlando, SeaWorld Orlando is underfunded, and we'll see capital investments over a 5-year plan. They're calling for major additions, a major and a minor addition, like a TikTok cycle. And they're talking about adding parking lots and new resort locations on undeveloped land. Is this too little too late? Are they biting off too much? Can they chew? What are your thoughts, Bob?
I haven't seen their yearly financials, but you know what? They need something there that's going to be able to compete on the same scale as the Harry Potter attractions at Universal. You know, since Harry Potter's been open in both the studios and IOA, and plus the publicity struggles that SeaWorld's having, they really don't have a powerful draw. They need something that's really going to suck people through the door, and they don't have it now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mike, what are your thoughts?
You know, you talking about that, it seems more like Disneyland Paris at the beginning, where they built all the hotels and downtown Disney and nobody came, except SeaWorld's not Disney, so it's even worse. Well, so they're going to build – they have nothing to draw people to stay there, really, besides Discovery Cove, right?
Yeah, they have Aquatica, they have Discovery Cove, and then they have the main park.
But what you have to remember is that SeaWorld is located – in a really interesting place in terms of being able to access and egress Interstate 4. Mm-hmm. So if you stayed in a SeaWorld property, you could be both at Universal or at the Disney parks in just no time at all. Very convenient location.
Yeah, it's similar to how Universal, you can just take a few lefts or rights and get on there, but even easier. Something I brought up on Twitter, and I saw excuse me, a few fans and some of our friends comment on is, could this resort strategy be a phase one of having SeaWorld possibly looking for a sale, understanding that they're undersold, so if they can build up more, people would be interested in buying the parks? Do you think that's an option? Mike or Bob?
No air in this balloon, brother.
Yeah. Fair enough. Mike, what are your thoughts?
I guess it's better for them to build up the value, but I think if I were going to buy it, I'd buy it now when there's nothing there. So you can just kind of do what you want.
And just be all cash and extra land?
Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay, well, it's going to be interesting at SeaWorld because it feels like they've kind of just made a few too many mistakes. And they just haven't addressed things very well. You had the Aquatica, the Antarctica attraction. That was a dud. You have Mako, which is coming, which is good. But then you have Blackfish. And then it seems like you just had a bunch of negative press continuously over and over and over again. So, anyway, that's with SeaWorld. And let's go to Universal real quick. Yeah, where Mike... Well, we'll get to the thing you're excited about, Michael, in a little bit. But... the first big news is that online Universal announced that December 3rd will be the final day for the Beetlejuice Graveyard Review. Actually, I'll be missing it by a day, as if I'd see it. I wouldn't see it, but actually, it seems like they'll close on Wednesday, And then it will be closed on Thursday. So if you want to see the final show, go December 2nd. Orlando United wrote up real quick. This marks the end of an era for Beetlejuice as a character, has been featured at Universal Studios since 1992. And they have not talked about if they're going to continue the character anywhere else in the park. So I know that the show is not very well written, for lack of a better term. Bob, have you ever seen the Beetlejuice Graveyard Review?
Oh, yes, many times.
What are your thoughts?
Loud.
Okay. I think that's a good review. Loud. Yeah, it just... I don't know.
Did you think I was going to be a deep thinker?
Yeah, no. Not at all. Yeah, it just never really appealed to me, and plus with the bad reviews I've been hearing, there's just no incentive for me to see it. I believe, you know, the people who, like, participate in the show are probably really good, but it suffers from Universal's kind of bad track record with large-scale productions, just like the Sinbad show and that Toon Lagoon show they had back in the day. Have you ever seen it, Mike?
No, so I'll never see it, I guess.
Oh, well.
That's about six times better than Sinbad.
Yeah. Well, say, can it be really six times better if Sinbad's zero?
Well, multiply it.
Yeah, there we go.
It's
infinitely better. It's the same level. So also announced, I believe it was October 28th, so right before we went down for the final night of Halloween Horror Nights, Mike, we'll let you talk about this one mostly, but Jimmy Fallon announced Race Through New York starring Jimmy Fallon, which is replacing Twister. Twister closed, I believe, November 1st, and they had their last shows on November 1st. So, Mike, do you want to give the case for Jimmy Fallon? Some of my friends refer to it on Twitter, Race Through Jimmy Fallon starring New York.
We don't know what it's going to be, so I'm excited. I mean, we have some ideas, but I'm excited to see what they come up with. It can't be any worse than what was there. And I'm going to give it a shot. The week that Jimmy Fallon came down for his shows was fun. They have some good bits, and they seem to get theme park humor. So I'm excited to see what they do. The Simpsons writers had a field day with theme park jokes. And, you know, if there's a good working relationship between Universal Creative and the Jimmy Fallon writing team, I think it could be fun. And, you know, we talk about, you know, I'm going to use my business terms, like bring it back into commerce. I mean, that's an area of the park that hasn't been used in a long time, even though Twister's been open. I mean, it's not much of a draw. And despite what the malcontents online will say, Jimmy Fallon is quite popular in this country and around the world. So people are going to go wait in line for that or whatever that queuing system will be. And they're going to want to go see that. And I think it's a good thing for the park. It'll get people to go to that area. They'll buy merchandise. It'll get us more rides in the future. So I'm excited about it. And we're going to, you know, it's taking something that you walk through and adding a ride component, no matter what it ends up being. And you can repurpose it in the future. And I'm excited about the aesthetic enhancements of the New York area. And, you know, I'm just excited to see what they come up with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the idea of the attraction because it sounds like it's going to be another simulator in an area that already has Shrek. A 3D simulator, nonetheless, which would be Shrek, Minions, and then Fallon right in the same area. So that I think, and also Transformers in a way. While they're all a little different, they're all kind of very similar. Kind of feel, I would say. So, I mean, that's the issue I have. I don't think the attraction itself, the writing will be bad. I mean, Jimmy Fallon's incredibly popular, and I think the visual enhancements will be great. I just question the ride system, I guess is what it comes down to.
Well, and we really, I mean, we don't know what it's going to be.
Okay. Well, I mean, they have some photos of him, like, in those... the black suits with the little dots on it.
Yeah, but we don't know if it's the flying theater or if it's Jimmy Neutron.
Okay. Well, no matter.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Bob, do you have any thoughts on Race Through New York starring Jimmy Fallon?
I like Jimmy Fallon's writers. I think if they skewed a little bit more adult, that it could be pretty good.
Yeah. I think that could be interesting, is because I actually got to do, when Jimmy Fallon was down, 2 years ago, was it? Mm-hmm. Down in, no, it actually was a year ago, 2004, I think. So a year and a half ago.
He hasn't been doing the Tonight Show that long.
Yeah. So a year and a half ago, I got to see him in Orlando, and that was a lot of fun. So I think it could be good. I guess there's just too many questions right now, and not enough answers. So, is there anything else at Universal, Mike? Halloween Horror Nights dates. Halloween Horror Nights 26 dates, which is...
Yeah, which changed last year, so why would you, stock them this year?
Yeah, fair enough.
Just expect them to be open the usual time.
Yeah. Do you want to touch real quick on the scare actor stuff?
No, not really.
Not really? Okay, fair enough. Just wanted to bring it up. So, excuse me real quick. Our big guest tonight is Bob Selinger. He is the author of the Unofficial Guide series. I have your bio pulled up right now, Bob. He's a Lowell Thomas Award-winning journalist, is best known as a creator and producer of the Unofficial Guide series. He is accredited with being the first to apply research techniques from the field of operations and research and statistics to travel guides. So welcome, Bob. Thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
So I just want to first of all and say, I actually was exposed first to the Unofficial Guide like in 2008. No, not 2008. 1998. There we go. 1997, 1998 time frame. My buddy showed me the guide when we were going with his family to Disney World, and I've been buying the books ever since. And I actually have another friend that I met up with, and they had like this bag of old Disney stuff, and in it was like the Unofficial Guide to Disney World, like 1992 or something like that. So it's really interesting to see how the books kind of just progress throughout the years. Bob, what's your background, your educational professional background, and kind of more about you?
I've got a strange professional background. I was a professional river outfitter for a number of years, and then I had publishing company from Ann Arbor, Michigan, asked me to do some kayaking and canoeing guides. I did those, and that's pretty much how I broke into publishing. I was teaching for a while at Kentucky State University. I was doing statistics and marketing research and operations research. And during that same period of time, I took my kids to the Disney World and spent what I thought was a fortune, only to stand in lines all day long and maybe see five or six attractions. And, bottom line, it really pissed me off. I thought there's got to be a way to orient and channel people counter to the flow of the traffic in the parks, and thereby minimize the amount of time that you wait in line. So it was, basically I didn't have a book in mind at all. It was a personal vendetta. I was just irritated. So I came back and I started working on some models about how to get people moving counter to the traffic in the parks. And it turned out to be a complicated thing because it involves ride engineering, it involves hourly capacity for the attractions, it involves where people go when they walk into the park, whether they turn left, right, or go straight to Fantasyland, if we're talking about the Magic Kingdom. So there were just a whole lot of variables, but I pecked away at this for a long time. And finally, I developed a plan that I thought might work and went down again with my children, and it worked very, very well. And that initial research, which became a whole lot more sophisticated as the years went by, turned out to be the cornerstone of the original Unofficial Guide to Walt Disney World. And then the same year, we published the Unofficial Guide to Disneyland. And the same research methodology was at work there and gave us similar results.
That's cool.
That's cool.
So you guys got interested in theme parks when you went down with your kids when you're still a professor. So that's kind of how you got interested in theme parks.
Yeah. You know, I grew up with Disney, so I was pretty familiar with the Disney product. And I have to say, the first time I went to Disneyland, the first time I went to Walt Disney World, I was incredibly excited. I mean, this was a physical manifestation of all this stuff I'd been watching on TV for most of my life. So I had high expectations. I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. And they did produce a superior product. But on the other hand, they made it damn difficult to enjoy it. And so I figured if I could take this product that was difficult to enjoy and figure out a way to enjoy it without standing in line all day, then that would be a great thing for me and my family. And ultimately, it turned out after the fact to be something that launched a series of books.
Yeah. The question I have is, what you kind of touched on this a little bit about models and other things like that, but what else also separates the Unofficial Guide series of books, whether it be Disney World, Disneyland, Universal, or any of the other books that you produce? What differentiates the Unofficial Guide series from other sorts of tour guides or tour books?
Well, I think we take a much harder consumer approach. We were the first objective guidebook to Disney World and Disneyland. This came at a time when Disney had this sense that they could not be criticized. They, you know, it was almost a divine right as far as they were concerned. And in fact, when we were doing the first edition of the Unofficial Guide to Walt Disney World, I called Burbank to talk to their legal department, and I asked them for a list of all of their trademarks and copyrights as applied to the theme parks. And this lawyer said, "What do you want that for?" And I said, "Well, I want to be able to recognize all your marks because I'm in the process of developing a guidebook to Walt Disney World and also to Disneyland." And he just flat said, "You can't do that without Disney permission." And, you know, actually, they kept guides from being published for years and years and years just by saying that. I'd been in publishing long enough at that time to know that was a crock. It's like telling somebody who reviews a Broadway show for the New York Times that they can't write a review. So I politely thanked him, hung up the phone, and hired somebody in Washington to go in, research all the trademarks and copyrights, and we just went ahead with it. But that was part of the Disney mentality at that time. You know, let's just scare people off.
That's amazing. I didn't know that at all. Anything else that kind of just sets the books apart? Because I know you're working with Len Testa on some of the touringplans.com stuff and more of the mathematical models and things like that.
No, there's a number of things. For one thing, we take what we call a marketing concept approach. So, you know, you take the average travel guide, you've got some author that's going out and seeing some particular destination, he writes it up. That's all going to be through the prism of his particular taste and preferences. What we did was we studied our target market. We studied the people that are going to be using the book before we studied the destination to find out exactly what it was they were interested in, what they wanted, and how they wanted it packaged. And there just were no other titles on the market, particularly in reference to Disney, that took that sort of approach. We invest in our books. To us, if we need to spend money, we're going to spend money because we want the product to be And I say that advisedly. A lot of people in publishing don't like calling books products. I don't mind so much. But we wanted it to be the best that it could be. You know, Disney, for a long time, maybe it slipped a little bit lately, but, you know, one of the things that always impressed me about Disney is that they always wanted to exceed expectation. And that's what we always wanted to do. We always wanted our books to exceed expectation. We wanted to really give our readers something valuable and something that would work to their advantage that nobody else could give them.
Cool. Mike, do you have any questions so far for Bob?
No, I'm just fascinated. I'm listening.
You're listening? Well, chime in if you have any questions. Okay.
So we've always taken a team approach. Yeah. You know, there's about 32 different people that contribute to the unofficial guide to Walt Disney World every year. Everybody from child psychologists to statisticians to hotel inspectors. It's a big crew that puts together that book. And that's one of the reasons that it's very singular. It's one of the reasons that it's superior to competing titles, because we can do things that a single author or even a couple of authors can't do. We can invest 10 people who do nothing but ride buses at Disney World for a whole week, and nobody else has the team or the background in terms of research design and methodology to do this.
That must be terrible for those people riding the buses all week, just going to Disney World. And it's like, where are you going down for? It's like, I'm riding buses for a week.
Well, it can be terrible. You know, we were talking about funny things that happened to us. We had this one guy that rode a particular bus all day long, and finally the bus driver was so accustomed to the person being there that they forgot about him. So when his shift was over, he just drove him right back to the bus barn.
That's pretty good. Did the guy have to explain what he was doing to the bus driver? Like, the bus driver think he was like some sort of crazy person or whatever? Or?
No, not in that case. But you know, there are a lot of times when we're collecting statistics, when we actually have people out with stopwatches and clipboards and things like that. And, you know, probably for the last 15 years, we've contacted Disney and let them know exactly what research we were doing, so that when security bumped into these people, they wouldn't have a fit. But in the beginning, that really raised the eyebrows of some of the Disney security. These days we just warn them in advance. We tell them what we're doing, and there's not a problem.
That's cool. I'm trying to figure what else. Oh, is there any other kind of interesting, different work that goes into the books? You mentioned, you know, riding the buses or hotel inspectors. Or are there any other kind of just things that you don't expect to see in a tour book that actually goes into creating the unofficial guide?
Yeah, I think just the depth of research, and sometimes, you know, I fight with Lynn over this. You know, Lynn would go in there with some sort of a critter scanner and try to see how many microbes were battling it out in the carpet. I mean, he gets into the detail like nobody I've ever seen. But we try to keep our research detailed. We don't mind getting in the weeds. In fact, we love the weeds. And it's the depth of research that sometimes really reveals some interesting things to us. But that's part of our shtick. It's part of our mentality. We like to be able to go into fine detail. And, you know, there have been times when Len wanted to research one thing or another. I said, it's not going to lead to anything. It's not going to be valuable to the reader. And he would do it. And it's just like, you know, when NASA sends a spaceship up, there's all this technology on the spaceship. And then 10 years later, you turn around and that space mission has generated a lot of viable, practical applications for the consumer. And so I would say that in terms of some of the stuff Len's talked me into researching, we've gone in with a very limited agenda and come out with just an amazing array of information that we were able to interpret to our readers that can really give them a leg up.
That's really great. I can just see Len going down there with like going all Dateline NBC with like the black lights and everything. That'd be great. Do you have any other funny or amusing stories that over the years of collecting information or things you've seen in the parks or anything random?
Oh, there's all sorts of stuff. We bump into things all the time. there was this woman, and she just happened to be walking ahead of me and a couple of our other folks. And she wanted to take a look at the park map, which was in her husband's pocket. So she reached into her husband's pocket and started groping around for the map. And then she just happened to look over her shoulder, and her husband was behind her. So she was rummaging around in some other guy's pants. And, you know, there was no evidence that he objected to this in the least.
That's fantastic.
There was one time when I was in a restroom, and I can't say exactly what happened on the other end, but, you know, there's like about 7 or 8 stalls, maybe even 11. But at the far end, there was a guy in there with a toddler. And while the guy was busy, the toddler crawled under the restroom separation into the next stall. Oh. And he popped up in front of the person in the next stall, and he says, "What's your name?"
Oh, God.
Guy answered the question, so that was good. That was fun. So he crawled under the next stall. And finally, he made it all the way down to me, which must have been at least 7 or 8 stalls.
Oh.
Pops up in front of me, and he says, "What's your name?" I said, "I'm Bob. What's yours?" You know, these are the sort of things that we bump into. There was a woman in shorts and a tube top with the 7 dwarves tattooed at the base of her spine. So it looked like the whole 7 dwarves were trying to climb out of her britches.
You got Mike.
Yeah, it's stuff like this. You can't make it up.
Yeah, it's just too good. That's fantastic. You see, Mike is our resident introvert. So just I can just see Mike like just being in that situation with the little toddler, and just that makes me laugh so hard.
I'd be more concerned about the germs. I'm a big germaphobe.
Oh yeah, that's true. You're a germaphobe, and you hate water rides. So it's combining all your worst fears. So Bob, let's kind of look in the future a little bit. What kind of trends do you see forming in theme parks right now? I'm like, kind of where are things going, and what are your opinions on that kind of stuff?
Well, I think Universal's really turned the theme park industry in the United States on its head. I mean, that they're able to produce the kind of attractions with the technology that they're using on about a 2-year turnaround is just phenomenal. You know, it takes Disney that long to make a decision to do a study. And here's Universal can crank out just a really headliner attraction in about the same time. So I think that everybody's going to be looking at a shorter fuse in terms of attraction development. That's going to be really, really hard for Disney because they're so bureaucratic internally. But I think that they're going to have to adapt. They've raised the bar in terms of the scope and the theming. You know, it's whatever. You know, my other B is Las Vegas. I've been covering Las Vegas since about 1986. And we had a situation at that time where Steve Wynn opened the Mirage Resort, which was totally different than anything that had ever been built on the Las Vegas Strip. And it created an entirely new standard. And to this day, if you want to play the game in Las Vegas, you have to meet that Mirage standard. And that's what's going on, I think, with theme parks in regard to what Universal has done. They've raised the bar. They've made it a whole lot harder for anybody to get any attention with something that's not totally spectacular. You know, in any particular year other than the last two or three, if you had opened the Seven Dwarfs Mine Train, it would have been like the hit of the year. But compared to what Universal's been doing, it was just kind of like a big burp.
Yeah, it was just like a speed bump.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm looking at that. I'm also looking at all the ancillary amusement facilities and things that are going into Orlando. Clearly, the indication or the trend is that between Universal and Disney, that they are increasing the aggregate market by enough that there's going to be plenty of spillover for these smaller attractions. And if, you know, if people didn't believe that, they wouldn't be spending millions and millions of dollars to put these things up.
Like the Orlando Eye, the Skyplex.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking of. And Old Town. And I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. And they live off of the pickings that Universal and Disney leave.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on My Magic Plus and that? Is that the similar kind of thing where they're raising the bar, or is it a misstep, or what are your thoughts on it?
I'm sorry, on what?
On My Magic Plus at Disney. The Fast Pass Plus and the Magic Bands and stuff like that.
I hate it. I mean, that's one of the things that sometimes I've liked about Disney and sometimes not liked so much. They're not afraid to challenge the status quo. So here we have a situation where they had a perfectly good fast pass system that everybody liked and that most people understood, and they replaced it with something that's so complex. And we have a cartoon in the book about people going into this store where on one side of the store they're doing tax returns, and on the other side of the store they're teaching people how to use FastPass Plus. I mean, you know, to me, it's insane. We get all this reader mail and all this email. Every day, I'm probably getting 25 emails or letters from people telling me how much they hate FastPass Plus.
Wow.
I think it's a train wreck. I think they've done something that they've spent a lot of money on, and Disney-like countries never wants to admit that they're wrong, but they have hatched something that has taken all the spontaneity. That in conjunction with advanced reservations for dining, I mean, who wants to plan their trip 5, 4, 3, 6 months out? Do you know what you want for dinner 6 months from now? Do you know whether you want to go to the Magic Kingdom or Epcot on a particular day 6 months from now? It, you know, we've always been big planners. We've got our touring plans, and people give us a lot of hell about that because it robs the spontaneity of the visit. But now there is no spontaneity. And God forbid you don't have those fast passes reserved before you go, then you're stuck waiting at a kiosk that'll probably take you longer than standing in a standby line.
Yeah, something interesting that I want to see if you agree on this is, it seems like Disney decided to build FastPass Plus as a way to push crowds towards smaller attractions like Country Bear Jamboree and Tiki Room and those sorts of rides, instead of building new rides. So this was more of a capital expenditure during the recession to get people on those smaller rides than it was to build new rides.
Well, it may be that, but I think the real reason was to keep people in the park. If you've got somebody that's coming to Orlando for a 7-day vacation and you set up a system whereby they have to identify which particular park they want to go to every day and pick attractions, and they want to decide, and they have to decide what restaurant they want to eat at every night, you're making it a lot harder for them to get off campus and try these other parks and attractions in the Orlando area. Now, it's like Magical Express. Magical Express was specifically designed to keep people from renting cars. They didn't want people to rent cars because they didn't want them to go off campus. So they introduced Magical Express. It is easy. It's free. And once you get to Disney World, you're stuck.
Yeah.
You're dependent on Disney transportation. All of this stuff. And if you look at it in aggregate, it's all designed to keep people on campus, every bit of it. Free dining when, you know, during the fall and off seasons. I mean, why rent a car? You know, you can eat free with the free dining plan. It's a concept that is rooted in monopolization, keeping that person who visits Central Florida on Disney property for every second that Disney can hold on.
Yeah, and I actually think Magical Express is probably one of the smartest things Disney's done in 20 years in regards to that.
Yeah, it is. It's brilliant.
Yeah, and I mean, and also not only not renting cars, but then they don't even think about mirrors or cabs or anything, so they don't even have exposure to the overall transportation. And then you have the video screens in the buses, so they can watch the previews of where they're going to go next, and they don't even look out the windows. So
that's true too.
Yeah. So I think that's probably one of the smartest things they've done in 20 years. And I agree with you definitely, because I think there's a correlation between the amount of planning you do before your vacation and you know, how long you stay on property, whether that be Universal or Disney. Or not on property anywhere, like if you just stay at iDrive, for example. I guess my last question, unless Mike has some more, is where is the future of the good book, the unofficial guide, going? Kind of what's the future? What's that looking like?
Well, if you guys work with Len Testa, you would know that there's no horizon. You just keep plugging along. And the further you can get in the weeds, the more fun.
So just more weed stuff. Just finding more little crazy things to look for.
Well, they're not crazy things. They pay off. But the opportunity is in the mining. You know, if you're not looking, you're not finding. And when you're not finding, your product stagnates. And we keep looking, we keep finding new applications that we can provide to people on touringplans.com. And we keep finding new, interesting, and useful information that we can put in the books. And we tie them together, so it's kind of like a tag team. And it takes care of somebody bound for Disney for their entire trip.
Cool. Mike, do you have any questions?
Nope.
Just enjoying the ride.
Yep.
Cool.
Well, so, he's the introvert, right?
He's the what? Sorry.
Didn't you say he was the introvert?
Yeah, that's true. He is. He's just sitting back and listening.
Yeah. Well, you know, we could end it. He could tell a joke. That would be fun.
Yeah, Mike, do you have a joke for us?
I got nothing.
Okay.
We have one question, though, from the audience I do want to cover, because you kind of brought it up, Bob. This is from good friend of the podcast, Gregory Lane Nichols asks, what's the best part about having dinner with Len Testa?
Well, the best part usually is he picks up the tab.
One of everything.
Len is an incredibly generous person. He decided one day that he wanted to test the capacity and the nimbleness of Be Our Guest restaurant. So he this they probably hadn't been open 2 weeks. So he walks up to the greeter, and the greeter says, "Yes, sir, how many in your party?" And he says, 120. And literally, I never would have done this. I'm a lot cheaper than Lam. But Lam had 120 people he's going to take to lunch and be our guest. And they had to call out management, cooks. They practically had the whole staff hovering there with that greeter trying to sort out how they were going to accomplish this. But they did it. They wow. handled it. And they handled it brilliantly. But that, you know, that's one of Len's greatest hits. You know, that's in the whiz bang.
That's amazing. I'd never heard that story before. That's fantastic.
Well, I'm sure you have Len on from time to time. Ask him to tell you about that. It's a hoot.
I'll have to. Well, we haven't had him on in a little bit, so we need to get him back soon. He's been real busy with stuff, and also just all the, his La Cava, tequila adventures, and all that stuff.
I was so happy when he discovered La Cava. Len Testa has the metabolism of a hummingbird, and if tequila will ease him off a little bit, that's just the best thing that's happened.
That's great. Oh, that's amazing. So, Mike, you have a joke for us?
I got nothing, man.
You got nothing? You have any questions?
No.
Oh, jeez. You're so difficult, Mike. What are we going to do with you? Well,
put me out of my misery, please.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do. Well, Bob, thank you very much for joining us tonight. It's been really a privilege and an honor. I've been reading the books forever. It's fantastic to talk to you about all this fun stuff and get all the dirty stories about Len Testa for blackmail purposes.
Yeah, we'll have to do 3 more shows to get those in, but I've really enjoyed it as well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. So where can we find you on the internet, or where can we find more about you, Bob?
You know, I lay low. Now, I'm sort of the inconspicuous of the duo. So, you know, it's going to be hard to find me. I'm not even on Facebook.
Okay. So you're laying on the mattresses right now because of the mafia.
Right.
Okay. We got that.
That little bio that you've got is about all that's available.
Okay. Okay. Well, cool. Well, we can still buy the books. You can find them on Amazon. Just search for The Unofficial Guide. They're available on Kindle and your hard copy if you like killing paper. You can go to touringplans.com. Not killing paper, killing trees. Jeez, what am I talking about? You can go to touringplans.com. They have a great blog there. Mike, where can we find you at? Nowhere. Oh, yeah, I forgot. Sorry. You can find all of us at Parkscope. You can find me at Parkscope Joe on Twitter. You can find us all on Parkscope.net and Parkscope on Twitter. Leave us a review on iTunes. And I think we have to mention we're on Stitcher, too, for some legal reason. I don't know why. Anyway, Mike, do you want to close us out?
Love everybody, hate everything. Kung Loosh.
See you guys later.
See you.